Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. CNI stands against America's negative role in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war party's relentless push to bomb Iran, and the roles played by twisted Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia in justifying it all. The Council for the National Interest works tirelessly to expose and oppose our government's most destructive policies, but they can't do it without you. Support CNI's push to straighten out America's crooked course. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. More than 2,800 interviews in my archive at scotthorton.org, and also you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show if you're interested in that kind of thing. All right, so our next guest is Bill Kaufman. He is the great author of Look Homeward, America, Ain't My America, and Bye Bye, Miss American Empire, and he's the writer of the screenplay of the new movie Copperhead. Welcome back to the show, Bill. How are you?
I'm terrific, Scott. How you doing? I noticed a theme. I seem to be overusing the term America in these titles, don't I?
No, it's all right, because that's what you write about, and it's great.
Yeah,
because...
well, that's our country, man.
Yeah, you're a front porch Republican. What the hell is a front porch Republican?
Well, it's a small R Republican. I don't know. I mean, I've for a lot of my career, if that's not too pretentious a term, I've written about sort of the little way, the alternative America. You know, the country we might have had that you know, and there's a lineage that goes all the way from the. You know, the anti-federalists through the local focos and the populists and the old right and the new left and, you know, the libertarians today. You know, people who stood against war and militarism and the centralization of power and stood for what I think is a more humane and human scale way of life.
Well, you know, I was looking at your Amazon page and I was kicking myself for not having read all of these. I've actually read just the one, Ain't My America, which is... a history of the entire, you know, Republican, all the different anti-war movements and all the different sort of very localist, inward-looking, anti-adventurism type movements that we've had throughout. And it seems like the peace forces always lose and the victors always write the history. So, you know, we've really got to turn to you to learn these things.
We've been getting our ass kicked for 200 years, I'm afraid.
Yeah, exactly. Carlin said we average a major war every 20 years, but, you know, that depends how you define major, because it seems to me it's more often than that. But.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a lot of great hidden history, you know. The there's a lot of stories in the footnotes, I find. Mm. And that's, you know, that's where I like to delve.
Well, I like your movie. I watched it yesterday. And
you did?
Yeah, it's based on a novel by Harold Frederick. Who's that?
Harold Frederick was he's an interesting guy. He's born in Utica, New York, which, in my opinion, is the literary capital of New York State. Partisans of Gotham might disagree. Anyway, he lived in the second half of the 19th century. he was, for about 15 years, the London correspondent for the New York Times. He died young under a cloud of scandal. Turned out he had two families, unbeknownst to each other, in London, and he was actually under the he had very bad luck to be under the care of his Christian Scientist wife, rather than the wife who believed in medicine. And so anyway, an illness went untreated. But he was is better known as a novelist. His novel, The Damnation of Theron Ware, which is about a Methodist minister's loss of faith or crisis of faith. F. Scott Fitzgerald called the best American novel written before 1920. And this movie, Copperhead, is based on a short story or long short story or novella called The Copperhead, which he published in 1893 and was included in a volume that contained a number of Civil War stories. And it's about a an upstate New York farmer, an old-fashioned Jefferson Jackson Democrat in 1862, who doesn't believe in the war, who doesn't want his son to go off to the war. And the war ends up splitting his family, other families, and in fact the entire town. Frederick was he went into a long eclipse, but he was discovered by one of America's great literary critics, if not the greatest, Edmund Wilson, in the 1960s. And Wilson was blown away. He said that he said Frederick's Civil War fiction is like any other Civil War fiction, in that it eschews both like Battle Hymn of the Republic, Northern Righteousness, or Dixie's, you know, Moonlight and Magnolia's romanticism that ignores, you know, the hideous evil of slavery. His stories instead focus on the home front, which is always small upstate New York towns and villages, where there was great ambivalence often about the war. And the stories are about, though, this great line by Stephen Crane, who was also a Frederick admirer. I forget it now, but said something like, you know, Frederick's stories illumine the tables set for three instead of five, and the mothers and wives and girlfriends waiting for men to come home, and these men may never come home. So it's about the casualty of war that we never think about in all our wars, which is the home front.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing about the Civil War. I don't know what kind of controversy this is going to cause, but I imagine that this is going to be a pretty big deal, and that some people are going to be upset, because at least the way I learned it in government school is that the universal consensus in America and even in the South is that all that blood was the price that the nation had to pay to get it right finally and abolish slavery and prevent it spread into the West, et cetera, like that. And the movie does not ignore these issues. They're tackled in the movie, but you are challenging that entire theme.
Well, although, you know, it's I don't know. I mean, it's not a political movie. It doesn't. I mean, I think you'll be seen broadly as an anti-war movie. But it's Ron Maxwell, the director who did Gettysburg, Gods and Generals. He's, you know, our foremost cinematic interpreter of the war. He and I hate message movies. I mean, I hate polemical movies that pound you over the head. And so in this. In this movie there are there's really only one exchange about the rightness of the war between Abner, the Democratic farmer, and character Avery, played by the great Peter Fonda, who's the eloquent and respected spokesman for the Union cause. The movie's not really revisiting the question of the war, though it's set there, and it's, you know, like I think, any art it has to be particular and localized. It's about a specific man and a specific time and a specific place.
Right.
But there are obviously universal themes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the movie has a political point, to me it's a defense of dissent. You know. I mean, it's very easy. Of course, everyone says he's for dissent, you know, or everyone's for the First Amendment. Everyone is for, I disagree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. But I don't know how often we really mean that. And so most works of art, movies, plays, books, whatever, about dissenters, to me, they really stack the deck, you know, and they mark the cards because the author flatters himself and the audience that of course the dissenter is right, and of course all right-thinking people, including you, the audience member, would be on the side of the dissenter, because the dissenter is always someone, you know, the guy who insists that the Earth goes around the sun, or that, the Earth is older than 6,000 years, or they're, you know, they're the witches at Salem, and who's not going to. It's so easy to stand at a great distance of years and miles with Galileo or with the Witches of Salem or with, Scopes and Darrow in Inherit the Wind. This movie, I think one reason that it's challenging is that it shows at the center that many audience members may not instinctively want to stand with. He's a farmer who's against the war. He explains why he's against it. Maybe you'll agree. Maybe you'll disagree. But he's gradually ostracized by the community, and a horrible act is committed. And I don't know. I mean, I think it challenges audiences in the way that historical films seldom do.
Yeah, well, I would certainly agree with that. And so I see what you're saying. I guess I was just sort of thinking of the knee-jerk reaction is going to be to make the protagonist an anti-war guy in the greatest, most justified war ever is pretty challenging to the audience right there. But then I see what you're saying, that what you're really getting at is, you know, you want to pick a subject that people aren't going to agree with. You don't make a Lysander Spooner out of him where, oh, he's even more abolitionist than anybody else, but he's anti-war or something like that, right? You don't patronize us like that. I see what you're saying. Like, ultimately, what you really want them to stand for is love thy neighbor and respect thy neighbor's right. He's still a man. He's not a snake.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's, there's an element of... I mean, there are any number of strains coursing through the movie, because films are always a collaborative enterprise. And there's one strain, I think, that you can find in the movie of Christian pacifism, which was once a powerful force in this country, and which still exists at the margins. But, for the most part, unfortunately, our churches have not stood up against the nonstop wars of recent years. But it's set during the Civil War, and you know that if, normally if you have a an anti-war dissenter, well, he's got to be the bad guy, you know. You got to, we should have painted, like, a snidely whiplash mustache on him, you know. We should have had him kick a dog or something like that,
yeah.
You know, to establish, or smoke a cigarette. I guess that's how you do it now.
Well,
right?
But you couldn't have made him
bad guy.
You couldn't have made him a Southerner, though, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. We should have, normally in the movie, I have to find a working class Southern guy, wearing a baseball hat. Oh, yeah, clearly, that's the bad guy. In this case, he's a Northerner. And it's also, remember, it's an upstate New York, anti-war Northerner who were different. I mean, you did find, among the Copperheads, the most rabid anti-war Northerners. In southern Illinois, southern Ohio, there's a certain, sometimes, cultural affinity with the Upper South. And so sometimes you would find among those people, it would amount to defenses of slavery, or I just don't care, you know, that sort of attitude, a sort of indifference to this, great injustice. But this is an upstate New Yorker, and, there was an interesting... I mean, again, I'm extremely parochial here. I mean, I think American history would have turned out better if people had listened to upstate New Yorkers, which they seldom have. But, there was an upstate New York Democratic tradition of sort of being limited government Jeffersonians, but also recognizing, that slavery was a blotch on the national discussion and, needed to be extirpated peacefully. And so even through someone like Martin Van Buren, I mean, the most prominent New York Democrat of the first half of the 19th century, and in a lot of ways kind of a party man and a Democratic wire puller, he bolts the party in 1848 to run as the first presidential candidate of the anti-slavery Free Soil Party. So there's a sense in which Abner Beach is in some way part of that tradition, which is kind of a singular tradition in Northern Democratic politics. It's part of the film's, it takes on broad themes, but there's also kind of a particularistic quality to it. I mean, it's set in a specific place, and so the characters and their actions are in some ways expressions of that place.
Right. Well, and it's funny because it's a very alien world to me. I'm from Texas, and so it's America, but... I don't know too much about upstate New York, really. I've only even been to Manhattan one time.
Yeah, well, that's to me, that's one of the glories of the country. That it's It's diversity, you know. It's true diversity, and that's one of the problems with political discourse today. Is that, you know, we get the corporate media try to stuff everything into this idiotic, you know, red blue duality, you know, or Republican Democrat, you know, Team A, Team B, as though two colors, you know, two colors are enough to paint, you know, the variegated and multi-hued country we have. I mean, to me, you need all the colors in the rainbow in the palette, and. I think it's great that Texas and upstate New York are different, and Texas and Manhattan, and these places were more different. You know, there's been a lot of homogenizing forces over the years, and really in the 20th century, especially, war has been one of those homogenizing forces. You know, it helps create and anneal like a national culture. You know,
mm-hmm.
Because we're always told to not to look into our own backyards, but, you know, to look toward Baghdad or Hanoi or wherever.
Right. Well, and, you know, I hope this isn't going too off topic, but I think this is the kind of thing that you talk about in your books, too, is, well, and sort of like you're saying, the homogenization of political views and just the way we live all together, too. And I always think of George Carlin's rant about how from coast to coast in every town now, every town is exactly the same, with the Bed Bath & Beyond and the Old Navy and the big concrete block strip malls, and there's mini malls and strip malls connecting to major malls and all the malls and whatever. And to me, that is all just a side effect of the central bank, which is primarily a function of the empire, and the war machine needs the central bank in order to disguise the cost of the empire as we look towards Baghdad, whatever. Well, at the same time, you get a generations-long construction boom in commercial property. It doesn't mean, and so, like you're saying, kind of the counterfactual history of America, how it could have been if people had listened to your kind all along, that sort of thing. Things could be very, very different. The degree to which we are homogenized, it doesn't have to be that way at all. I mean, we could have, equal protection of rights without having to have our culture just shaken to where we're all just the same. But it really is a side effect of, like you're saying, always looking toward, you know, who's next, the Indians or what, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's always an enemy. I mean, here we thought there wasn't going to be an enemy at the when the Soviet Union dissolved. You know that Gene Kirkpatrick had said that if that ever happened, well, America would go back to being a normal country. But there was no peace dividend, as you remember. And I don't know. Now we seem to have more enemies than we can count. Even though in the country itself, there's very little enthusiasm. I mean, I could go up and down my street and ask my neighbors, are you in favor of sending ground troops to Syria? And I'd get either befuddled stares or heartily shaken heads, no. But,
right.
You know, when's the last time public opinion counted on matters of war and peace?
Yeah, none, of course. They just speak as though no one even challenges the premise that the president gets to draw red lines wherever he feels like, and then he can move them if he wants to, and he can use them as a casus belli if he wants to, too.
Sure, yeah.
It's only up to him.
Yeah, and you don't find ten years ago the Iraq War was launched, and the folks who propagandized for it are still the folks who I gather are on the talking head shows, and I get these people like John McCain or Lindsey Graham who have never met a foreigner they wouldn't like to bomb into submission. And yet, you know, they're treated with deference, with obsequiousness. And the people who were right about the war, I don't know, Ralph Nader and others, I mean, they're invisible in the national media. I mean, I this is an old complaint, of course, but, the being against a war tends to be a very bad career move. So,
yeah.
which is why careerists seldom make it.
And, you know, I don't think I was ever really naive. I mean, I've been reading about secret government since I was a kid, and Reagan was, you know, hiring death squads down in Central America and stuff like that. But I remember thinking there's got to be some kind of accountability for the media people that just went blindly along with the Bush administration's claims about the warehouses full of chemical weapons that we swear are there and their advanced nuclear program and all this stuff. And then there was no accountability at all. It became a red-blue thing, as you pointed out, and that was it. It went away. Half the population still identified so strongly with the Republicans at that point that they took the side of the guys who lied us into war and said it didn't matter, or maybe they're all in Syria now, or whatever they needed to tell themselves to justify it.
Yeah, yeah, and the Democrats, who were some very eloquent critics of the war and of the Patriot Act and clampdown on civil liberties, but, you know, a lot of them, once it was a Democrat and once their party gains the White House, they lose their tongues. And the founders saw party politics, especially the division of American politics into two parties, as a disaster that was to be avoided. There was obviously very quickly. Kind of binary system was set up, and at this stage, I mean, attempts to launch something a third party, the main parties have so rigged the game that and with ballot access laws and such that it's tough. But there are a lot of great culturally, there are a lot of great currents out there, from community supported ag and farm markets and the resurgence of regional literature and poetry and home brewing, all sorts of stuff. So, a lot of people understand that things have gone off track and kind of groping to get us back on the path. So,
right.
I mean, I'm a congenital optimist, but...
You sound like it. Well, that's good. You know, there's a lot of nullification efforts on left-wing and right-wing identified topics, right, from healthcare to gun control and medical pot,
sure,
and those kinds of things as well. All right, now let's talk about the movie more here.
Yes.
It's Copperhead, the movie. Of course, on the line is Bill Kaufman. He wrote the screenplay for it. It's directed by Ron Maxwell, and it stars Billy Campbell and Peter Fonda. And the website is copperheadthemovie.com. And now there's a way that people can help out with getting this movie into the local theaters. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, there is. I'm a little bit of a techno cretin, so I don't know if I can exactly explain, but you go to the website, www.copperheadthemovie.com. The film opens nationally June 28th in theaters in quite a few cities in the country, but it's not going to blanket the country the way that, you know, Batman 6 or one of those does. And if you'd like your local theaters to get the film, there's a button you can push on the computer. I hate to sound like a little old lady talking about a car, but if you go to the website and you go to the Facebook page, there's a way to, I think it's called Demand Copperhead, and you could do that. And that would be great, because as Scott said, I guess he saw a screening, and it's a good movie. I think it looks at American history from an angle seldom encountered in American popular culture.
Right.
And it's challenging. It's not a didactic or preachy movie. I think different people will interpret it in different ways. And I think it's entertaining. Ron Maxwell's a terrific director. There's a fantastic cast. Billy Campbell, the star, is really a subtly powerful performance. And we're proud of the movie. And I hope you all see it.
Oh, yeah, you definitely should be. It's a good one. And like you said, it is going to be very challenging. I hope it'll be very controversial and that it'll turn out to be really successful. I actually can't imagine that it won't be very controversial, because I certainly...
Well, that'll sell tickets, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's good. And it's good for, you know, challenging people on the ideas you're trying to challenge them on. It's certainly, the most, you know, I've never seen a protagonist make a case for, if not Southern secession, at least a lack of Northern invasion to prevent secession in something you know, major like this in major theaters going around, that kind of thing, or on TV, you just don't ever hear that point of view of all, at all, ever. And so there will be people
it's
who
done,
are...
It's, done, it's not even done in a partisan or taking sides way, but it's... we're trying to, in the limited political discussions in the film, and we want the sides to be represented fairly, you know?
Right.
Which, you know, and this is an unusual side. I mean, you know, Northerners against the war. It's like Southern Unionists, the, you know, the Southerners in eastern Tennessee and other parts of it, northern Alabama and elsewhere, who did not want to go to war to preserve slavery. I mean, they, you know, they saw it as a... as people often have over the years, wars fought by the poor and for the rich. You know, and I think there are terrific movies to be made about Southern Unionists, just as there are about anti-war Northerners. And,
you know, we were talking about foreign policy a little bit there, and there was one thing I was thinking during the movie was about, you know, the parallel with the current wars and how they're all so far away. And though even though the vast majority of the Civil War was fought on southern ground, still the northern casualties were so high. I mean, it really affected everybody throughout the entire northern part of the country and in every community. But with the Iraq war, a million of them died in the war that just happened there. The Americans lost about 4,500 soldiers and a couple thousand other contractors and NGO types and that kind of thing. And then, of course, a few tens of thousands of casualties, which are all horrible for those individuals. But otherwise, it's all so far away, and to the American people now, the Iraq War might as well have been back during the Korean War, you know, in the 50s or something. It's out of sight, out of mind, long gone, and I wonder whether they'll be able to comprehend, whether they'll think of the Iraqis at all, that like, yeah, it must really suck to have the Union bomb the hell out of your town, you know? I never really thought of that.
Yeah, you're right. Again, I mean, the film's about the home front in the north, and I mean, the one, I mean, even something like our current wars, I mean, obviously the impact on the home front is less, but still, you know, young fathers and mothers being deployed, you know, which happens in every town and city across the country. The images of, like, you know, a young mother being separated from her, you know, 3-year-old to go across the ocean to serve the empire, I mean, to me, those photos are obscene, you know, and I think a lot of, you know, I mean, maybe I'm just an old-fashioned American and thinking that, but I think a lot of people would have the same reaction. And so I still think there's not much enthusiasm for foreign crusades, but you're right that the impact at home isn't quite the way it was during the World Wars or Vietnam.
Right. Well, I do hope the movie will make people think of that a little bit, that, you know, the war can't be, the Iraq War especially was much more violent than the Afghan War, even though it's lasted that much longer. And I just wonder whether people even think of that at all, you know? I hope so. Because I think that, you know, like we're talking about with the media accountability, if there's no kind of personal moral accountability, like, oh, geez, I cheerled for that, and that was kind of wrong after all, huh? If we don't even admit those kinds of things to ourselves as just regular people, not that I got it wrong or anything, not that you did, but anyway, the people who did, without even just the personal kind of admission about it, then we're just on the path to being lied by the same liars and being the same gullibles into the next situation, just as bad or worse.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly see very few public or private acts of atonement. I mean, if Dick Cheney had a soul, he'd spend the rest of his life washing bedpans in a veterans hospital, but I kind of don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, or see any of these guys with a washcloth cleaning up depleted uranium dust in Fallujah. That's what I want. Doug Feith with a weight around his ankle, a ball and chain, you know, and a wet washcloth. Anyway, sorry. Listen, I'm sorry, we're all out of time, Bill, and I don't know how I got so far off topic from your film to my fantasies about Doug Feith's punishments. But anyway, you are a great author, and you are now apparently a great filmmaker, and I really appreciate your time on the show very much.
Well, thanks. I hope everyone goes out and sees Copperhead.
Me too. Thanks again.
Thanks, man.
All right, y'all. That is Bill Kaufman. He is the writer of the screenplay of the new movie Copperhead. The website is copperheadthemovie.com. Amazon.com. And he's also just a brilliant author. Go check him out at Amazon.com, all his books. Ain't My America, Look Homeward America, and Bye Bye Miss American Empire. It's Bill Kaufman, the front porch anarchist, little R Republican, something or other like that. Isn't he great? Go see this movie. It's really good. And it comes out, did he say June 28th or June 6th? And how did I confuse those numbers? They don't even rhyme. Comes out in June.
Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writerMichaelSwanson.com for more details. Hey y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, everybody. Scott Horton here. You ought to consider advertising on the show. Here's how it'll work. You give me money, and then I'll tell everybody how great your stuff is. They'll buy it, and we'll all be rich as Republicans. Sound pretty good? Shoot me an email, scott@scotthorton.org, and we'll work it out.
Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Oh, easy.
Into the scanner.
Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.